Is it true that sugar feeds cancer? Do you really need to detox? And what should you eat when you've been diagnosed with breast cancer? As a breast surgeon, I had no idea that my patients were scouring the internet looking for a miracle diet. But the minute I became a patient, I realized just how much misinformation is out there regarding what we should eat. Today, I'm going to set the record straight with the help of Dr. Claire Shaw, consultant oncology dietitian and author of the Royal Marsden Cancer Cookbook. This is So Now I've Got Breast Cancer, the podcast for anyone who's just been diagnosed. I'm Dr. Liz O'Riordan, the breast surgeon with breast cancer, and I found out the hard way just how little I knew when I suddenly found myself in the chemo chair. It's why I wrote my book, The Complete Guide to Breast Cancer. There's a lot of bad information out there, and I want to guide you down the right path. So if you've got a question, this show will answer it for you. Now, I'll be honest, I assumed my breast cancer patients would know what to eat, the same as everyone else. There was no special diet. And then I got cancer myself, and my social media feed seemed to be flooded with cancer diets, cancer-busting superfoods, and miracle supplements. And I had no idea there was so much confusion about what you should and shouldn't be eating. And judging by the hundreds of questions you sent me, it's time to set the record straight. And I can't think of anyone better than Dr. Claire Shaw. She was a consultant dietitian at the Royal Marsden Hospital in London for over 35 years, and she now works with the British Dietetic Association Oncology Specialist Group. She chairs the National Institute for Health and Care Research Cancer Nutrition Collaboration, and the second edition of her best-selling book, The Royal Marsden Cancer Cookbook, has just been released. Welcome to the show, Claire.
Thank you very much, Liz. I'm really delighted to be here.
Before we start, I have to say thank you for saving my marriage during chemo. I felt so sick and everything tasted awful, and I lost 3 kilos in my bad weeks, and my husband had no idea what to feed me. And then my bridesmaid sent me your book and everything got just a little bit easier. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Liz. That's a really lovely thing to say. And just to say that the book was really based on the questions people had asked me during my career. And I tried to translate that into sensible advice and ideas for recipes that were practical.
It really is. And I've sent it to so many people who've got cancer and I can't recommend it enough. But if we start with the basics, Melanie in Sydney has got stage 4 disease and she wanted to know where she can get some no bullshit advice. And so many people have said, how do you know who to believe?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think unless you come across a dietitian during your care, obviously I've been an oncology dietitian for many years. Dietitians are a regulated healthcare professional. So in the United Kingdom, they are regulated by the HCPC, which is our governing body. So that is a way of protecting the public. So I am a great advocate of saying, please go to a registered healthcare professional. But I realize in this day and age, not everybody has access to a dietitian. I understand that. And some people may look at nutritionists and think, would they be a suitable person to contact and ask for advice? I would tend to think of nutritionists giving more sort of general advice. They're usually not trained in medical conditions. And one of the aspects of nutritionists is it's not a protected phrase. It's not a protected title. So anybody can call themselves a nutritionist.
So I could be a nutritionist.
Yes, you could put that in your lovely long list of all the things you do, many of them, Liz, because it's not a protected title. So you might get somebody who is very well educated, very knowledgeable about nutrition. If they have been through an education that is rigorous enough, they can be registered. And that's on for the Association for Nutrition do have a register, but not everybody who calls themselves a nutritionist will be registered. And there is no comparison really across their qualifications.
I had no idea.
Yeah, I would really encourage people to seek out a registered dietitian. In the United Kingdom, you can do that through the British Dietetic Association, and they have lists of freelance dietitians, and it will say their speciality. So again, I would encourage people to look for somebody who is specialised in cancer. It is a specialist area of knowledge and expertise. So, you know, if you have particular questions, you really need to seek out somebody who does have that knowledge.
That's really helpful because I get sent videos every day of cancer patients saying, I've cured myself, I did this, there's a study. And often someone can make a huge claim, but often it's cell and my studies and it's all might and could and may and not if. How can we understand whether research people are telling us is actually worth following?
I mean, you're right. It is a minefield. And even when you're a professional, to keep up to date and look at the evidence and know how strong or how good a study is, that, you know, that is a whole minefield in itself. I would say definitely go to reliable sources. The World Cancer Research Fund is a charity that funds research into lots of different aspects of cancer. Their main body of evidence is about cancer prevention, but more recently they have done some really good global reviews of evidence for cancer survivors in particular diagnostic groups, and breast cancer being one of them. So they published a report in 2018 and they've just done an update on that. So that's taking all the evidence that is available. So that gives it much more strength. So my go-to would be something like the World Cancer Research Fund, where you're looking at a body of evidence, studies that have been pulled together. And even in that, there will still be some ifs and maybes and some buts. But we can be a bit more confident about that as a source of information.
Brilliant. So I think it's realizing if someone's telling you this could cure you, if it's could and if and might, it's not evidence and you don't need to follow it because there isn't the concrete proof yet. But I've had so many questions about what we should eat. Nicole wanted to know about how much protein, carbs and fat. Lynette and Artie wanted to know, can diet reduce your risk of recurrence? Anna asked, do superfoods exist? What is a healthy diet after breast cancer?
So I'm going to quote the World Cancer Research Fund again.
Yep.
And really their go-to page about prevention, cancer prevention, is applicable to everybody. And then I'll talk about some specific things that relate to breast cancer. But we talk about plant-based diets, and that really is what we should be thinking about. And people probably say, well, what do you mean by a plant-based diet? Do you need to be vegetarian or vegan? You don't. So what we're referring to is the majority of food that you eat coming from plant-based foods. So vegetables, fruits, whole grain cereals, nuts, seeds, that type of thing, with sources of protein. Very important to keep your muscle mass sufficient and strong. And you probably talked about that during your exercise podcast.
Yeah.
So when we talk about protein, fish, chicken, eggs, moderate amounts of red meat, and by that we mean about 3 portions a week, and avoiding processed meat as much as possible. Limiting alcohol. I'm sure some of your listeners will have questions about alcohol, which we can address later.
We'll come on to that later. Yeah.
Limiting sort of fast foods and sugar sweetened drinks. So really going to a diet that is based on good healthy ingredients. We haven't touched on dairy foods.
We're going to come to that later as well.
Yeah, but it can include dairy foods. Maybe watching about the fat content of foods, but we will touch on dairy foods for a number of reasons, including calcium and bone health. And within that diet, really thinking about the impact it has on body weight, maintaining a body weight as near as possible in the ideal range and being physically active. But I hope that's given a description of the sorts of foods that people can quite happily eat. And they are delicious. And there are lots of great recipes out there.
It's boring, but it's just basically a healthy diet with a rainbow of fruits and veg, isn't it? There's no one cancer diet that can stop it coming back.
No. I was just going to say, it's not about those individual foods. It's about the balance and the variety.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of talk about, you know, even in a week, not sticking to the same foods, but having that variety of particularly plant-based foods.
Yeah, it's really important. So you get all your vitamins and minerals, don't you? Now, we've had a couple of questions. Nikki asked us, how do you cope? Is there anything that can help with the joint pain that you get with the side effects of the breast cancer drugs? And we had this voice note from Mafe.
Hi, Liz. So I have a question, and it's about diet after breast cancer. I've been suffering a lot from pain on my joints, muscular pains, a lot of pain in all the right side of my body was where I had my lumpectomy. I'm afraid that this is due to not having my periods also for almost 2 years when I started chemo. So what do we have to do to avoid all of this?
Can diet help with the side effects of the joint pain?
That's an interesting question. I do know that there's a lot of thoughts about an anti-inflammatory diet in conditions such as rheumatoid arthritis. But I haven't seen any evidence that diet can influence the side effects that your listener described there. But the anti-inflammatory diet is really the sort of diet that I've described, possibly with a focus on fish oils, which are anti-inflammatory. But I'm not sure there's sufficient evidence to say actually that will impact the side effects of the drugs that are causing the pain.
And actually, the best thing for joint pain is the last thing you want to do, which is just regular exercise and to stay moving. But again, an anti-inflammatory diet is a normal, healthy diet full of fruit and veg. We keep coming back to the same thing, don't we?
We do.
And it's boring and it's hard work cooking all your food from scratch. But so let's talk about bone density and bone health, because a lot of breast cancer treatments make you menopausal and they can make your bones weaken and thin. And we're not exercising, we're not doing weight training. It's really easy to get osteoporosis and break your bones. How important is diet in helping to reverse this?
So diet is part of the jigsaw. And there are, as you know, Liz, there are a number of things that affect bone density, but your calcium and vitamin D are important. Now, we were told during the pandemic that none of us are taking sufficient vitamin D. And the recommendation nowadays is that the whole population should take a supplement of 10 micrograms or 4 international units of vitamin D each day. We all need about 700 milligrams of calcium, which is fairly easy to do if you do include dairy foods in your diet. Just to give you an example, a 200 ml glass of milk would give you 200 milligrams of calcium. So it is relatively easy. Now, I am aware that some people are a bit hesitant about dairy products. There is no good evidence to avoid dairy products. There are some suggestions that if you're worried about your weight and your fat, saturated fat intake, that you should look to some lower fat dairy products, but there's absolutely no strong evidence that people should be avoiding dairy. So yes, it is important. Now, if people are known to have lower bone density, then the requirement levels go up. So you'd be looking for at least 1,000 milligrams to 1,200 milligrams of calcium and possibly 800 to 1,000 international units of vitamin D. I would hope that most women would know about their bone density, that they'd had a DEXA scan before they started on hormone treatment.
Just to say, that's the women taking an aromatase inhibitor like anastrozole or letrozole, because tamoxifen is bone protective, but the aromatase inhibitors aren't. So you should be given a DEXA scan, that's a bone scan, and told to take a calcium and vitamin D supplement as standard, ideally.
Yeah. And even though if you are very rigorous with your diet, you might reach the calcium intake you need, it's unlikely that you would reach the vitamin D intake. And actually, you need a supplement to make sure you have it every day. And as I said, it's part of the jigsaw. So there are other things that are important, like weight-bearing exercise. And there are things in your diet that reduce your absorption of calcium.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So things like tea with the tannins in it can bind with calcium and reduce the absorption. So if you need...
Move my cup of tea away there.
So if you need a supplement, then it's really important that you get the right supplement and you take that.
Yeah. And I think that's the only real supplement you do need. We've had a lot of questions about weight. And I had this as well. I put on 10% of my body weight on tamoxifen and I'm slim and no one could notice, but it's still a lot. And Samantha, Rochelle, Emma, Sean, Anne-Marie, Erin all say they're struggling with the weight gain that comes with breast cancer treatment, whether it's chemo or the drugs. Are there any tips about how to tweak our diet to try and help stay a healthy weight?
Yes, there are. You're absolutely right, Liz. It's probably the strongest evidence that keep trying to get your body weight within the normal range and keeping it there and avoiding some of the weight gain. But it isn't easy. My tips would be, firstly, the diet that I described is the best one for healthy eating and watching your weight. But I would say if you really need to tackle weight gain, you need to go a step further. So you need to try and find something that helps you in the longer term. And for different people, that will be different things. So there's quite a lot of interest in sort of intermittent fasting.
Mm.
Some people might know that as the 5-2 diet.
Yeah.
And some of my colleagues up in Manchester have done quite a lot of work on that in relation to breast cancer. And it's not that that diet is better than just a daily calorie restriction, but for some people, they find it easier to keep to. So as I say, it's finding something that ticks what helps you. And for some people, it might be a friend who needs to do the same. For other people, it might be finding a weight loss group, you know, like Weight Watchers, Slimming World, something reliable that's not into fads and that gives that ongoing support. So whilst we can talk about the foods, I think my biggest point would be find something that helps you keep to it.
Yeah. And I think for me, I don't think of it as a diet because diet means I'm restricting myself. It's a healthy way of eating. And for me, it was having a lot more protein to keep me full. But we mentioned fasting and Nadine sent us this voice note.
Hi, Dr. Liz. I've got a question for you relating to diet. I'm experimenting with fasting, eating later in the morning. My reason for this, my understanding is that it helps with healing if we're not continuing digesting all the time, giving our bodies a chance to heal, but also from the point of view of helping my immunity. I'm just really confused as to whether it's a good thing to be doing or not.
What a good question. And it's a question that lots of researchers have as well. And the jury is still out on that. And I do know there's a study going on in the Netherlands at the moment that's funded by the World Cancer Research Fund, looking at just that. Does fasting make any difference to side effects of treatment, immune function? But we don't have the evidence at the moment to say that people should fast. So my advice is keep going with your normal diet.
Yeah. Can we just clarify what the 5-2 diet is for people that don't know?
Yeah.
And who are interested in that study? That'd be really helpful.
Yeah, so often when people want to lose weight, they'll just reduce their energy intake on a daily basis. But the 5-2 is sensible eating for 5 days, the sort of diet we've already talked about. And then on 2 days, restricting food intake, usually between 500 or 600 and 800 calories on those 2 days, concentrating on foods that are high in protein, low in carbohydrate. And some people find by just doing it 2 days, they can move those 2 days around, make it convenient for them. It helps them keep to this restricted intake. And I really liked your point, Liz, about not being on a diet or off a diet, because that's one of the, you know, the approach is very difficult if you think, oh, I've broken it, so I'm not going to bother for the rest of today. Actually, by identifying 2 days, some people find that that fits in with their regime much more easily and they find it easier to stick to.
It's kind of different from fasting where you are not eating for long periods of time. And we're going to come on to chemo in a minute, but there's a lot of people wondering, should they fast the 2 or 3 days before they have chemo? And I wondered if you knew what the evidence and research about that was.
I know there's a lot of interest in it. The idea is that it protects the normal cells as they go into more of a sort of shutdown sleep mode, but that doesn't happen to cancer cells. But we don't have good clinical evidence that that is the right thing to do. And the studies that have been done have not shown a big difference in side effects. Quite a few of the studies have just been carried out to see if people can adhere to it, which, you know, can be difficult in itself. And my concern is if chemotherapy is frequent, then you are actually restricting your intake on quite a few days. And we know that that is not a good thing to do.
And I think the few days before you start chemo is when your taste buds come back and think, actually, I want to eat food, and you need energy to recover from chemo. And it's miserable enough without starving yourself. So just to clear up, there is no evidence to show that fasting has an impact on your cancer outcomes, whether you'll die from cancer, whether the treatment works any better. So you don't need to do it. If you want to try it, that's fine. But there's no evidence saying it's a good thing. at the moment. But let's come on to chemo and your book. So Finola wanted to ask, why do our taste buds change during chemo? Why does water taste disgusting and things are salty or chalky or horrible?
Again, another very good question, and everybody's experience will be very different. But the chemotherapy is affecting cells that are multiplying quickly. And because of that, it will affect the lining of the mouth and the taste buds, which the cells in the taste buds are being renewed on a regular basis. So those cells will be killed, and there will be a time when actually they're not working as they would do normally. There may be other effects of treatment. So things like dry mouth, that affects taste, because to taste things, those substances need to be dissolved in fluid for the taste buds to pick that up.
And your sense of smell.
Absolutely.
I couldn't smell strong things, so that made food taste different as well.
Yeah, because you anticipate what you're going to eat because of the smell of it. And there are some foods, as we all know, there are some foods that actually smell and taste exactly the same. You know, things like those dreadful Parma violets that were around when we were children.
oh, don't.
But they do. They smell exactly the same as they taste. So smell is so important. And certainly from my experience, speaking to, you know, to people who are going through this, things change so differently with, you know, different cycles of treatment as time goes by. So there are no hard and fast rules. And what I did in the cookery book was collect lots of ideas from people who'd been through it, who told me that those things worked for them. And there are lots of ideas and suggestions of flavors and tastes to try.
It's brilliant. But this is a question. So I was given a small list of things to avoid, but a friend at another hospital was given like a 3-page document. And Rowena said she's been told that she can't eat yogurt with live bacteria due to the risk of sepsis. What do we really need to avoid and why during chemotherapy?
Well, the concern about food is about foodborne pathogens, really, things that could give you food poisoning. So you should be given a bit of guidance on foods that are high-risk foods. So things like sushi, unpasteurized milk, cheese made from unpasteurized milk. So I wondered, most dairy products in the supermarkets will be made from pasteurized milk. So it would be, I don't know if somebody's got confused. It's very unusual to be told you can't have live yogurt, because the bacteria in yogurt are not really pathogenic.
No, they're safe, aren't they, to eat?
Yes, they are. It is different in different cancers. So there may be some circumstances where people have got, say, leukemias and lymphomas, where their chemotherapy is really affecting their immune system much more strongly. So I wonder whether somebody's got a bit confused with the advice, but certainly in breast cancer, it's usually the dietary advice that's given to pregnant women.
Yeah.
To avoid high-risk foods. So things like pate is another one, because it can be a source of listeria. Eggs, we used to say avoid raw eggs or lightly cooked eggs, but if they're lion-stamped and in date, they're absolutely fine, because we know those come from chickens that have been vaccinated against salmonella.
Brilliant. And I guess it's basic simple food hygiene, really, isn't it?
It is. In fact, the Royal Marsden, on their webpage, and you can download their booklets, there is a booklet on food safety, which is just about food hygiene and, you know, washing your hands and all the sorts of things we know.
And we'll put all the links to everything you've mentioned in the show notes. Now, Tracy asked, is there anything we shouldn't be eating? Processed meat, ultra-processed food? Is it all ifs and maybes, or is it actually proof to show that some things may cause cancer or make it come back?
So specific foods, I think we can safely say that there are no specific foods that are at risk of making the cancer come back. What we're talking about with diet is that overall balance of what you eat. If you remember when I ran through the diet at the beginning of our chat, Liz, we talked about trying to reduce fast foods, sugar sweetened drink. Some people, the ultra processed foods, that's often a phrase we hear nowadays. These are foods, they are fine in small amounts, but the vast majority of our diet should really be based on those principles we talked about, plant-based diet with you know, moderate animal protein. And you don't have to eat animal protein. You know, I did talk about fish and chicken and eggs, but you can be vegetarian and vegan if you want. But there isn't evidence that if you cut out all animal protein that you would influence your chances of recurrence.
Brilliant. So you don't have to be vegan or vegetarian if you've had breast cancer, only if you want to for whatever reason.
That's correct.
And I kind of go by the 80-20 rule. I eat well most of the time, but I've had cancer. Sometimes I want chocolate or biscuits or cake, and that's fine. But let's come on to tamoxifen. Susan and Sally and Elizabeth and several other women have wanted to know, is it safe to eat grapefruits and oranges and tamoxifen? I know there are some contradicting studies. What things should we avoid if we're taking tamoxifen and why?
Well, the first thing I would say, Liz, is speak to your pharmacist because they will be in the know about drug food interactions. But my understanding with tamoxifen is that grapefruit and possibly some of the other citrus fruits do influence the effect of tamoxifen, and they stop the liver breaking it down. So it is more potent. But I would encourage you to speak to your pharmacist, and it should be listed on the drug information sheet that you get with your medication.
And again, a lot of you may not know who your pharmacist is or how to speak to them, but it's grapefruits. I think it's metabolized by an enzyme system that also does tamoxifen. And a lot of drugs can't be taken with grapefruit. But what about estrogens in food? Sasha, Denise and Julie were asking about the estrogens in cow's milk. Do they need to avoid them? There's estrogen in soy and soy supplements. And Nikki sent us this voice note.
People have scared me talking about eggs, dairy, soya, and the link with the estrogen in them. I'm vegetarian, so it's becoming really difficult to manage my diet, and there seems to be no help out there. I've tried to reach out to several sources, and nobody seems to be able to connect me with a cancer specialist dietitian. So yeah, any discussion around that would be really, really helpful. Plant-based estrogen, should we avoid anything? Because there's such conflicting information on the internet, it would be really good to have an opinion, a respected opinion on that. Thank you so much for everything you do.
That's great. What a great question. So your listener mentioned about estrogens in food. So phytoestrogens are actually plant-based estrogens, and they're substances that are present in some vegetables, but particularly soya foods. And they mimic some of the actions of estrogen, but they also mimic some of the protective actions of estrogen. So the jury has been out for a little while, but the evidence is building. Now, in the United Kingdom, we don't eat a lot of soy-based foods. So a lot of the evidence around phytoestrogens and soya in the diet come from Eastern countries like China and Japan. And they have seen that when they eat diets that are very rich in soy-based food and consume a lot of phytoestrogens, those people actually have a reduced risk of recurrence compared with people who eat lower amounts of phytoestrogens or isoflavones. That's a sort of active compound. So there is increasing evidence that it may be useful to include soya foods in the diet. So I think in answer to your listener, is to not to be worried about phytoestrogens in the diet. They may actually be helpful. In the last update from the World Cancer Research Fund, the evidence about soya is slightly stronger.
So soy naturally in the diet is fine, but soy supplements you do need to worry about, don't you? Because they're not regulated. You don't know what is in there, but eating soy is fine. And then what about the estrogen in cow's milk? Because a lot of people are worried about that. I've got people making their own milk out of nuts because they're so scared about the estrogen in cow's milk.
Oh, So my understanding is that in some countries there will be higher concentrations. They're allowed to use estrogens in the production of milk, which in the United Kingdom and in Europe, that's not the case. And certainly, as we discussed earlier on, Liz, there isn't any good evidence that avoiding dairy is beneficial. So I think, you know, the estrogens in milk, it does not bear out in the evidence that influences the recurrence of breast cancer.
No. And it's a tiny amount that you absorb, isn't it?
Exactly. So that really doesn't feature on the list of things that are important in your overall diet.
So just to summarise, if you have an estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, you can eat what you like in moderation. There's nothing you need to cut out for fear of causing a recurrence.
You made that very good point about phytoestrogen supplements, and they might be things like red clover, and we do not recommend people take them. They can have varying amounts of active substances in. As you said, they're not regulated. You don't really know what you're taking. And the amount of phytoestrogens and isoflavones you would take in comparison to diet is absolutely huge. So yeah, avoid them at all cost.
The only supplement you should really be taking is calcium and vitamin D, as we said, isn't it really?
Yep.
But let's go on to something that's kind of driving the internet crazy. And I've had so many comments to videos about this. Ola, Kerry and Virginia and Sharon asked this. Does sugar feed cancer? So Sharon was in a Facebook support group and it's being peddled, and she now feels guilty for eating a tiny piece of flapjack. Can we go through this once and for all? Does sugar feed cancer? Do we need to starve sugar from the diet?
I do know the sorts of things that your listeners have probably seen on the internet. It's originated from lots of theories years and years ago about laboratory experiments. Even if you cut sugar out of the diet, you do not deprive cancer cells of sugar. The body has a certain amount of sugar in the bloodstream, and sugar is, all cells need fuel, sugar or glucose being a fuel, but cancer cells are driven by many, many mechanisms. And the simple idea that you can remove sugar, which in the body, you can't actually do that anyway, because, you know, you need a certain amount of sugar in your bloodstream.
No.
Even if you removed all your sugar from the diet, you would still have sugar in your bloodstream. You cannot regulate cancer cell growth just by cutting sugar out of your diet. It's an absolute myth. So I hope your listeners don't feel guilty about having, you know, a little piece of flapjack. As you said, Liz,
piece of flapjack.
Yeah. Well, there are recipes of flapjack in the cookbook. You know, this is about what you do most of the time. And to include foods like that is absolutely fine.
And I think carbs and fruit get broken down to sugar, don't they?
They do. As do starchy carbohydrates. So, you know, when you're having starchy carbohydrates, they will appear as sugar, glucose in your bloodstream.
So a sugar-free diet would be very, very boring and miserable, wouldn't it?
It would. It's sometimes known as the ketogenic diet, which we might want to talk about.
Yeah, we're going to come on to that.
There's lots of different theories. If we take that a step further, if you are on a very low carbohydrate diet, you start to make what are called ketones. And there was an idea that some types of cancer couldn't use ketones. So that was another sort of strand to this low sugar advice. But again, in research, that has been completely debunked. And we know that cancer cells are very good, if they're growing, we know they're very good at using lots of different substrates. And there are many, many different drivers of cancer cell growth. And just cutting out sugar is not going to stop them.
No. So I think in a nutshell, yes, sugar feeds cancer cells, but it feeds all the cells in the body. And if you cut out sugar, you're starving all the cells in the body. And most people going on a sugar-free diet have already had the cancer treated. So there probably aren't any cancer cells left to starve anyway. So that is nonsense. But what about alcohol? Because I've liked a gin and tonic in my time. And although I don't drink much because I don't like the taste anymore, Karen and Adele wanted to know if their glass or two of wine at the weekend was okay after a breast cancer diagnosis.
I think this is a really difficult one, because I think we all know that to be careful about alcohol is good for our health, but it can be an important part of our lives and our social life. And the bottom line is, if we drink it in moderation, then it is absolutely fine. The recommended sort of limit is 7 units in a week. That's the World Cancer Research Fund, but avoid alcohol if you can. So if your listeners are going to have a drink every now and then, that's absolutely fine.
Brilliant. Thank you. It's important to live. And if alcohol and social occasions makes you happy, then it's absolutely fine. It's not going to have a huge impact. So don't feel guilty.
Absolutely.
Now, we've covered some of them. There are an awful lot of diet trends which are reported to help with a cancer diagnosis. I thought we could go through some of them. And one is, I put a story up on Instagram about a book saying that carrots cure cancer. And I wanted to know why it had had like 900 reviews compared to mine. And Melanie wrote in to say that she's juicing 5 pounds of carrots a day as she heard they have cancer-fighting properties.
That's a difficult one, isn't it? I think we touched earlier saying there's no one food, and likewise, there's no one nutrient that will stop cancer growing. So diets that are high in beta carotene, and that is the vitamin that's present in carrots, that diets that are high in that have been associated with lower rates of cancer. But on its own, it's not necessarily going to be helpful. So I would say, stick to the food. The juicing is an interesting one, because if you take lots of fruit and vegetable juices, you are taking higher intakes of vitamins, but you're not getting the other nutrients. You're not getting the dietary fiber. You're not getting much protein. So by all means, include them on an occasional basis, but they're not a magic wand. And you are actually better to eat the fruit and vegetables themselves.
Because you need the fiber for your gut microbiome, don't you?
You do.
And so just finally, we've got the keto diet, the alkaline diet, the Gerson diet, the Budwig diet, you name it. Do they work? Is it worth people spending their money on books and courses and juices to do them?
No, they don't work. And I would say, in a way, they can be very detrimental, because people can hang hope on something that is not based on good evidence. There can be a lot of an emotional response to it. There can be guilt if people feel they can't follow them. They might be persuaded by family, friends, etc. But there is no evidence that a particular diet, like the ones you've mentioned, are going to reduce the risk of recurrence.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That is the final thing we need to say. Just eat a healthy diet full of fruit and veg. And before I leave you, I just wondered if any of the listeners out there are still confused about where to eat or where to go for sensible information, what resources would you recommend?
So I've talked a lot about
your book. We must say your book.
Yes, thank you, Liz.
It's brilliant.
Thank you. I've talked a lot about the World Cancer Research Fund. And one of the things I really like about their website is that they provide recipes as well. So although they talk about nutrition and what you should be doing, they put it into practice and give you lots of ideas and inspiration. And I think if you look at that and put the two together, you start to get an idea of what would your plate look like in following these healthy eating recommendations. So definitely the World Cancer Research Fund. The British Dietetic Association Oncology Specialist Group have got a great sheet on myth busting. Cancer Research UK have got some really good things on their website. They do myth busting. And the World Cancer Research Fund have actually got a special section on frequently asked questions, just the sorts of things we've been talking about today, in language that is easy to read for both healthcare professionals and patients and families alike. So those are real go-to sources.
They are great resources. I'm going to put all the links in the show notes for anyone listening. And thank you so much, Claire, for taking the time to talk to me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Liz.
That was oncology dietitian Dr. Claire Shaw, who knows everything there is to know about what to eat after breast cancer. The takeaway for me is that there is no magic bullet when it comes to diet and breast cancer. In fact, having cancer is almost irrelevant. Everyone should be eating lots of fruit and vegetables with a good source of protein, regardless of the health, and no supplement or fad diet is going to cure you. And I'm sorry that we couldn't answer all your questions. There were so many, but Claire has agreed to come back next season and talk about what a healthy cancer meal plan looks like and what, if any, supplements you should be spending your money on. And now it's time for the gorgeous Donna Ashworth to read us her poem of the week from her best-selling book, Wild Hope.
Mother Nature's Hand. I think stretch marks, wrinkles, freckles and moles are by Mother Nature's paintbrush. I think love handles, thigh dimples and birthmarks are also by her fair hand. I think flaws and imperfections are the most interesting part of anyone's body. That crooked tooth, which squeezes my heart each time her smile flashes. That dimple. The way her face follows her eyes when she laughs so she can laugh harder and let go of all care. The line that forms between her eyebrows when her thoughts are hard. I think everyone is a work of art, actually. Like a magic picture. You just have to step back and really see.
That was Donna Ashworth reading Mother Nature's Hand from her latest book, Wild Hope. If you want to read more of Donna's poems, or find out about today's guest, Dr. Claire Shaw, or read her cookbook, or just send me a question to answer on the show, you'll find all the details in the show notes. And you can also sign up to my podcast newsletter for my bonus monthly tips. And if you've got a few moments to spare and you love the show, please leave us a rating or review wherever you listen. Next week's episode is the last in the series, and it's all about sex and intimacy. I'll be speaking to Charlene Douglas. Now, you may know her from Married at First Sight UK. She's a sex and intimacy coach who's regularly worked with women facing cancer, and she's got lots of great advice for us about how to love your body again, how to physically reconnect with your partner, or how to start dating if you're single.
The key is to not kind of, and it's weird me saying this as a sex therapist, to say, you know, like put sex aside for just for a moment, but what I'm saying is, you know, really focus on your own well-being, you know, learning about your body again, you know, what your body can and can't do, and then, you know, gently entering into the world of intimacy.
I'm Dr. Liz O'Riordan. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you then. So Now I've Got Breast Cancer is produced by Birdline Media.